My name is Paul McCarris. I'm the PPP maintainer for Linux. I work for Linux Caring. I'm going to talk today about the new PPP driver architecture in the Linux 2.4 kernel. I've got a bad cold, so I can't speak very loud. So if you can't hear me, can you come forward? Okay. So this is the outline of the talk. First of all, a quick overview of PPP. Then a quick look at how PPP is implemented in the 2.2 kernel and what's wrong with that. Then a description of the new interface that we've designed for 2.4. The changes we've made to the Linux PPPD. And lastly, just a little quick thing about how you can actually use multilink PPP under Linux with 2.4. Okay, quickly, PPP, I'm sure you all know, it's used to establish network connections over all different kinds of point-to-point links, most commonly dial-up modems. A lot of people use PPP over dial-up modems to their ISP. Also various kinds of synchronous serial links, ISDN links, and all sorts of other things, optical fibres, ATM, lots of things. PPP is really a collection of protocols defined by RFC documents, and the most important ones here, firstly the link control protocol used to establish the link between the two peers and configure various aspects such as do you have to authenticate, do you want to escape control characters, what's the largest packet size you can send. Then two authentication protocols, password authentication protocol and the challenge handshake authentication protocol. They're used for one machine to prove to the other machine that it is actually who it says it is and that it's allowed to make a connection or whatever. The Internet Protocol Control Protocol, that's used to configure things like what IP addresses you're going to use on the two ends of the link. The Compression Control Protocol, that's used to negotiate whether you're going to compress packets that are sent over the link. Now, of course, if one side's going to compress a packet and send it compressed, the other side needs to have a decompressor. So the CCP lets the two sides discover if they have any protocols in common that they can use for compressing packets. And lastly, the multi-link protocol. That provides a way of using several physical links in parallel to make a single virtual PPP link where you can actually split packets between the links and so get reduced latency and increased bandwidth. Okay, now in the 2.2 kernel, the most notable thing about PPP is that we have three or four separate PPP implementations that don't share any code and you use the implementation for your kind of medium. So if you've got an async TDY, like a dial-up modem or something, you use the async PPP. If you've got an ISDN line, then you use the ISDN PPP, which is a completely separate lump of code. Or for some particular kinds of synchronous serial interfaces, you use the sync PPP implementation. And then, of course, there are some smart wide area network adapters that actually do PPP in the firmware on the board. Now, I'm not going to talk about them because that's not really a PPP implementation as far as the kernel is concerned. As far as the kernel is concerned, it just looks like, you know, an Ethernet interface or something. So we're not going to worry about them. Now, the kernel user mode split, basically the principle is that we have enough stuff down in the kernel that we can handle data packets completely without going up to user space. So that includes the packet encapsulation and framing, compression, TCP IP header compression, and if you're doing multi-link, it includes the multi-link fragmentation and reassembly. Now, the reason for doing this is basically for performance. If you've really only got a 14.4K modem, then it doesn't really matter if you're coming up to user mode for every packet. But if you've got an ADSL line that's going at a couple of megabits, then it does make a big difference. Then up at user level, we have a daemon that handles the control protocols, the PPP control protocols that I mentioned before. For the async PPP, you use the standard PPP daemon. For ISDN PPP, there's a derivative which is forked off called IPPPD. Now, if we look at the async PPP, which is the one that I maintain, this is the structure. Don't have a pointy thing. Okay, so the PPP module in the middle here has actually got two parts, two sort of personalities. One is that it looks like a network interface, such as... There was a pointer? Oh, it doesn't matter. You've got this part on the right which looks like a network interface, a PPP0 or whatever network interface. And the part on the left looks like a TTY line discipline. A line discipline is a module of code that you can put in between a serial port or a pseudo TTY and the user level code that's reading and writing from that serial port. So for instance, when you're using a console, you've got a virtual terminal there, and it's in a line discipline which gives you the line editing and echoing characteristics, so that when you type characters, they echo. When you press the delete button, it removes characters. That's done by the line discipline. Now, if we have a device which we want to use for PPP, we take off that standard normal line discipline and we put on the PPP line discipline. What that means is that this code, this PPP line discipline code, gets firstly to be able to send characters out and secondly to process the received characters. And for data packets, it doesn't send them up to the PPP daemon. It shunts them sideways to the network interface. Now, this is fine for the normal sorts of situations where you have a dial-up modem, you're dialing up your ISP, it all works fine. Where it becomes restrictive is firstly if you want to do multi-link, because if you want to handle another TTY, then there's another one of these things, and suddenly you've got two network interfaces. And you don't really want two network interfaces because you only have one virtual link. You only want one network interfaces, but it's using the two devices. Secondly, it makes it harder to share code with, say, an ISDN port or a synchronous serial port or something. Okay, so during the 2.3 series kernels, I basically threw out that code and started again with a module dividing the PPP stuff into a module that handles all the common functions that are used for just about any PPP implementation on any medium that you could care to name. And then below that, we connect in modules that we call channels, which handle the specific details for different sorts of media. So we have, in the generic module, we have the network interface unit, the PPP0 or whatever. We have the interface to the networking code and the interface to PPP daemon. We have the packet compression and decompression and the TCP/IP header compression and decompression. We have the code for detecting network traffic, so we can do idle timeouts and demand dialing. And we have the code for multi-link PPP, the fragmentation and reassembly. Now, all of those things are things that are independent of whether you've got a serial port or an ISDN connection or whatever underneath. Then underneath we have different kinds of channels. These handle specific details like, for instance, when you're doing PPP encapsulation on an async serial line, you have to do things like if there are certain byte values, you have to escape them by putting in a 7D byte and then a mangled version of the byte. And you have to put in a 7E byte at the beginning, at the end and possibly the beginning as the frame delimiter. Now, if you're doing PPP over an HDLC link, then those details of framing and transparency are handled usually by the hardware in lower levels. You do bit stuffing instead of byte stuffing, and you have various bit combinations that are used for the frame delimitation and that sort of thing. So we have a PPP async channel that knows... Is that a question? No? We have a PPP async channel that knows how to deal with TTY devices, a PPP sync TTY channel for some kinds of synchronous serial ports, a PPP OE channel that's used for PPP over Ethernet. quite common these days for people to get an ADSL connection from their telco or whatever, which comes in and it looks like an Ethernet, but then you do PPP over that so that the provider can then still do all the access control and whatever. So there, then we, in that case, we have PPP frames that are being transmitted over Ethernet and that come in and then go into the networking stack. And finally, an interesting one is that somebody's written an IR PPP channel type. What this does is it takes the frame, the PPP frame that's been given to transmit, and encapsulates it according to the IRDA specifications and sends it out the infrared port. So with that, you can set up, if you've got laptops or something with IRDA ports, you can set up a PPP connection. Now, you can, of course, do the TTY emulation over the IRDA port and then do PPP over that, but that gives you multiple levels of framing that you don't really need. With IRPPP, you can just do it more or less directly into the IR, into the IRDA frame format. Okay, so here's a diagram showing more or less how this works. We have the generic layer in the middle, and we have an instance of it that is basically a network interface. So we have our PPP0 and the TCP/IP stack or whatever talking to that. Then underneath we have here, I've shown two channels linked into the same PPP unit, and in this case they're both PPP async channels talking to TDY devices. So this is an example of how we might do multi-link. We have packets coming into the generic layer, getting fragmented, sent out both these channels and coming out both these TDY devices. Fragments coming in come in through the channel into the generic layer, get reassembled and passed to the network stack. You see that the PPP async channel implements a line discipline. That's because that is the way to get hold of the data from the serial port. One thing we can do here, of course, is that we could do a kind of heterogeneous multi-link. We can say perhaps this channel 1 is an ISDN connection. Or maybe your ISDN gives you 2 B channels, so you could actually have 2. One example where this might be useful is if you have a situation where perhaps your local calls on an analog line are untimed, but your ISDN calls are subject to time charges. So what you can do is you can have a dial-up modem, which is basically on permanently, which gives you your basic connection, and then when you need more bandwidth, you can bring up your ISDN channels and just connect them in and get the extra bandwidth. And then when you no longer want them, you can disconnect those channels and go back to just using your dial-up modem. Okay, here's the details of the interface between the generic layer and a channel. It's actually really quite straightforward. All that the channel really has to do is it has to be able to take a PPP frame in an SK bus structure and send that out on its channel, and it has to be able to receive PPP frames on its channel, put them in an SK bus structure and pass them up to the generic layer. And that's about it. So the channel has to provide two functions to the generic layer. One is the start transmit function, which says, here's a PPP frame, send it. Now, in fact, the channel is actually allowed to say, when its start transmit function is called, it's allowed to say, sorry, I'm full up at the moment, I can't take it. In that case, the generic layer will actually keep hold of the frame and send it again later. That's what this PPP output wake-up function is called, is for. That's for the function. That's for the channel to tell the generic layer, okay, I can take another frame now. And then usually the generic layer will then call the start transmit function again with the frame and say, right, send it now. And optionally, the generic layer can provide an I/O control function, which can then be called by PPPD down through the generic layer into the channel. There are 7 functions in the generic layer that the channel can call. The first, PPP register channel, that's called when a new channel has sprung into existence and the generic layer should know about it. Now, the generic layer doesn't create channels. Something else creates channels. So, for instance, in the PPP async case, a channel is created when a TTY is set into the PPP line discipline. In the PPPoE case, I haven't looked at it in detail, but I would guess that a channel is created when some user-level thing detects a connection, detects a UDP connection and packets that say, right, we want to set up a PPP connection here. So it's a general principle that whatever medium you have underlying the channel, there has to be a way to get at that and control that independently of the PPP stuff. Okay, so think about a TDY device. You can open the TDY device, you can set its speed, you can then send modem commands, you can then do various things to get that thing ready to talk PPP. Okay, then you make it a PPP channel and the PPP layer starts, the PPP generic layer starts talking to it. Or for PPP over Ethernet, you've got your Ethernet there, and what happens is you start receiving packets that say, from the other end, that say, you know, we want to set up a connection or whatever. Or you run a user mode thing that starts from your end. But in any case, there's something that happens there and gets things ready to do PPP. And then when it's ready to do PPP, you connect it into the PPP generic layer. Okay, so PPP register channel says, right, we're now ready to do PPP. Here's the channel. Go for it. PPP unregistered channel says, oh, sorry, can't use this channel anymore. Gone. So, for instance, if you have a modem and then it hangs up, that would result in PPP unregistered channel being called, and then from then on the generic layer won't try and use that anymore. Output wake up I've already talked about. PPP input is very simple. That just means channel's got a frame. Here it is. Go for it. PPP input error. That's called when, if your channel has detected that you've dropped a frame. For instance, if the channel has got a frame and it's checked the frame check sequence, the CRC at the end of the frame, and that's bad and it's dropped the frame, then it should let the generic layer know that it's dropped a frame. The last two are quite simple. PPP channel index. Each channel has got an index that's assigned by the generic layer. When register channel is done, and PPPD needs to know that index. So this is the way that you get the index, pass it back to PPPD, and that way then PPPD can actually connect into it. PPP unit number, that just says what if the channel is connected to a PPP unit, like a network device, what's the index of that? Okay, I think I've covered most of this. Multilink becomes relatively straightforward when we do things this way because we can connect more than one channel to one PPP unit. So then the PPP unit, like PPP0, that represents what's called a bundle in multilink terms. A bundle is like the virtual PPP link. And the PPP channel, each channel represents a single physical link. The generic layer handles the details of fragmenting and recombining the PPP frames. And, of course, your channels can be of different types. Okay. One of the issues in designing and implementing the PPP generic layer was to handle the details of really trying to keep the amount of transmit buffering to a minimum. It's best to keep the amount of buffering to a minimum to minimise latency and to make the... If the higher-level networking code is doing decisions about prioritisation and reordering of packets based on priority, then you don't want to have a lot of buffering below that because that means that the reordering becomes less effective. Okay, so starting from the top, when a packet is transmitted, we have a transmit queue for the PPP unit. It usually contains at most one packet. It can, under some circumstances, contain more than one packet. The start transmit function, the hard start transmit function of that network interface device always accepts the packet that the higher level networking code gives to it. But then there are flow control things there. There's the native stop queue and native start queue primitives in the networking layer that the PPP generic layer uses to flow control stuff into its queue. Coming down from the transmit queue, we then do the packet compression. The important thing here is that after you've done packet compression, you can't reorder the packets anymore. You have to send them out in the same order. Also, it becomes highly undesirable to drop packets, because what happens with compressed packets is that each packet is compressed based on the history of the preceding packets, so that if the receiver receives a packet and, you know, receives packet N, doesn't receive packet N plus 1, then when it gets packet N plus 2, it basically can't handle it, it can't process it, has to drop it, because to decompress it, it needs the history from all the previous packets. So in that case, there is a mechanism for resetting and recovering, but that involves round trips and it all gets very slow and your performance goes to zero. Okay, so after this point, we can't reorder and we really, really don't want to drop packets. Now, once a packet's been compressed, we then try and send it out one or more channels. Now, if we're not doing multi-link, basically we give it to the channel. If we're not doing multi-link, we only have one channel. So we give it to the channel, and if it takes it, good. If it doesn't take it, then we just save it for later. If we are doing multi-link, then at this point we fragment the packet, and we have a channel transmit queue for each channel, which, once again, usually contains at most one packet. And that's if the channel refuses the packet, that's the fragment. That's where we store the fragment for later. So really there should be at most one or two packets buffered up on the transmit side of the generic stuff at any time. This is all designed so that the channel, in fact, really only needs to store one packet, which is the packet that it's currently sending. This is why I made it so that the channel can actually refuse to take a packet in the start transmit routine, so that you don't really need any sort of a queue in the channel. You just need to have a place to store the one you're working on. And if you're not working on one, then that's fine. If you are working on one, then you refuse any more at that stage. There's no logic for timing out and retransmitting packets in the generic layer. That's all handled higher up in the core netcode. Okay. The generic layer has been designed fairly carefully and tested to be SMP safe. Obviously, we use spin locks to ensure the integrity of our data structures. In order to achieve this SMP safety, we have to ask the channels to provide some amount of synchronisation and mutual exclusion as well, and the generic layer can provide in return, some guarantees about how things work. Okay, so the channel is required to guarantee. When you call PPP register channel, right, the channel provides a PPP channel object which represents that channel. Now, the channel is required to guarantee that that actually stays in existence, that memory doesn't get freed, from the time that you call PPP register channel until after PPP unregistered channel returns. Now, on an SMP system where you could have multiple threads, this might require a spin lock. The channel is also required to guarantee for us that it's not going to be calling one of these, PPP input in one thread at the same time that it's calling PPP unregistered channel in another thread. Now, there are reasons. I mean, if you think about it, you can't guarantee the existence of an object with a lock inside the object. That's why I didn't put a lock inside the object to sort of guarantee this. But that sort of thing will typically require a spin lock or some sort of guarantee from the stuff calling the channel code to achieve this. The generic layer functions shouldn't be called from hard interrupt level. They can be called from soft interrupt or bottom half level or from mainline, but not from hard interrupt level. The generic layer gives a guarantee to the channels that it won't call, it won't re-enter the start transmit routine or the IO control routine, and it won't call one while the other is executing. So inside the start transmit routine, you can assume there's only one thread in there. You're not going to have two threads both simultaneously in your start transmit routine, two CPUs. The generic layer also guarantees that by the time that PPP unregistered channel returns, it won't be calling the start transmit or IO control routine on another CPU. Okay. Now, on the top side, where the generic layer talks to the PPP daemon, the way it does that is through /dev/PPP. This is a character device, and there's only one. There's only one /dev/PPP. The way we use this to actually talk to multiple units and channels is that each time you open dev/PPP, you get a separate instance. It's a bit like the Solaris clone open type thing. You get a separate instance of dev/PPP, which you can then attach to a unit or to a channel. So you can open dev/PPP and say, okay, I want to attach this to PPP2. And then once you've done that, you can do IO controls and send and receive frames and things using that file descriptor that you got from the open, and that will talk directly to PPP2. You can also attach it to a channel, so that once you know a channel number, 27, that might be you've just you've taken TDYS0 and put it into PPP line discipline, that made a new channel, so that's channel 27. You can open dev/PPP, attach it to channel 27, and then control that channel through that file descriptor. Obviously, you can send PPP frames by writing to dev/PPP, and you can receive them by reading from it. There are a number of IO controls. You can create a new PPP unit, do the attach, like I said. You can attach to a channel and then say, connect this to PPP2. So you can take your file descriptor that you attached to channel 27 and say, right, connect yourself to PPP unit 2. That way, that gives you the connection and gives the generic layer the way to actually send and receive frames. And then you can use IO controls to set various sorts of parameters like control character escaping and maximum frame size and that sort of thing. So the PPP daemon does all this. You don't really need to worry about this unless you're actually writing a new PPP daemon. And there are some people who want to do exactly that, and that's great. So there it is. Okay. I'm up to PPP 2.4.0 beta 4 now, and beta 5 is on its way. But from beta 2 and later, they will support the new generic layer, the new structure in 2.4. At the moment, we have the PPP async and PPP sync TDY channels, and the PPP OE stuff is actually in the kernel. PPPD doesn't have the PPP OE stuff in it yet. There's a bit more restructuring that's needed to be done to get that in cleanly. I think you have patches for the moment for B4?
Yeah.
Yeah.
B2?
B3. B3 didn't last very long. It had a bad bug.
As long as it works for me.
Yeah, whatever. Okay. PPPD has this plug-in architecture where you can add new code that's packaged up as a shared library, stick that into the PPPD executable, and add new functionality that way. I'm currently hacking into PPPD to make it possible to support a new type of channel using a plug-in. So then what you would do is you'd have your new channel type, and perhaps you'd have that as a kernel module. You load that kernel module, you run PPPD with the corresponding plugin, and you can talk to your new type of channel. What this plugin, the sorts of things this plugin would have to do are firstly, talk to your magic new. Okay, suppose you've got some new packet radio interface which has got some particular characteristics like you can't receive and send at the same time, and there are some other funny quirks that you need to cope with. Okay, so you write the kernel channel module that knows about all of that, does the encapsulation and framing, does the flow control, does the alternation of transmitting and receiving and so forth. That's fine. Then at user level in PPPD, what you need are functions like, firstly, something to get your new channel ready to do PPP. So you need something to, for instance, turn on the radio transmitter and do some fancy control stuff to actually find someone out there on the other side of the world who wants to talk to you over your packet radio interface. So then you're ready to do PPP. So that's fine. Then PPP, the rest of the core PPPD code can take over and do the PPP stuff. And then at the end, your channel plugin needs to do things like it needs to know how to stop doing PPP and say goodbye to the other guy and turn off your radio or something. Okay. The multi-link support, the basic functionality is there and working, but it still needs more development. The way it works at the moment is that we have one PPPD process per link, and we use a TDB, that's Tridge's Trivial Database that he wrote for Samba. That's used to match up links and bundles. At the moment, the first PPPD that you run will set up the first link and also control the bundle, and then you run another PPPD for the second link, and that will join onto the first one. Now, if you kill the second one, that's fine. That will take down the second link and you'll just revert to using the one. But if you take down the first link, at the moment, it will take down the whole connection. And that is undesirable. So that's something that needs to be fixed. Okay, so to set up multi-link PPP, you need a recent 2.4 kernel. You need recent PPPD. And the basic idea is very simple. You just connect to the remote machine twice, or three times, or however many times. So the separate invocations of PPPD are actually virtually identical. Usually it'll just be the device name that differs, so that you're using a different serial port or whatever. You have to use the multi-link option, of course, to tell PPPD that you want to do multi-link. Now, what happens is that there's this thing called an endpoint discriminator. This is a magic blob of data that's hopefully unique between different systems. So a good one to use, and the one that PPPD uses by default, is actually the MAC address on your first Ethernet, provided you've got an Ethernet. And during the multi-link negotiation, the two ends exchange their own discriminator, their endpoint discriminator. And then what PPPD does is it looks for... It says, okay, the other guy, he's got this discriminator, he's perhaps authenticated himself as this machine or user or whatever, and it uses that information and matches that in the database to see, have we already made a connection to that same system? If we haven't already made a connection to that system, then we just set up the first link, we just set up a new bundle. If we do find that we have already set up a connection to that system, then we say, okay, this is the second or subsequent link in a multi-link bundle, and we'll just join our link onto that existing bundle. Now, it's possible, I guess, that there would be some cases where the discriminator is pretty weak or the other end doesn't authenticate. And so what you can do is you can actually specify a third thing, a bundle name with an option to PPPD that becomes the third part of the key that is used to look up in the database. So you can actually use that to establish two separate bundles to the same system, or to make sure that when you're connecting to different systems that are using the same endpoint discriminator that they're actually different bundles. Jamal? Sorry? Okay. Okay, so when PPPT detects that the other system is the same system as one we've already connected to, it doesn't create a new PPP unit. So the first one would create, say, a PPP0. The second one doesn't create a PPP1. It just joins its link onto PPP0. There are some options related to multi-link, new options, multi-link, no multi-link, bundle. That's the one I just talked about that lets you discriminate between bundles. MRRU. That's, you know, the MRU option for PPPD is basically the maximum packet size. This is the maximum packet size for the whole bundle, which can be different from the maximum packet size for the individual links. In the multi-link specification, there's two different sizes of sequence number that you can use, 24 bits or 12 bits, and corresponding to that, the multi-link header either takes 4 or 2 bytes. If you use the MP short seq option, that will tell PPPD that it's allowed to use 12-bit sequence numbers and to ask the other end if that's okay too. And the endpoint option lets you set what the local endpoint discriminator is going to be. If you don't use that option, then it'll look for ETH 0 and take the MAC address on that. And as I said, there's now this var run pppd.tdb. That's a database of connections that contains more information than just the things I was talking about before. It actually contains details like what the process ID of PPPD is and what device it's using and all sorts of things. And that's for all PPPDs that are running. So it's possible now to write utilities that actually query that database and print out a list of connections, print out list of users that have got connections into your system, perhaps, and what IP addresses they're using and various kinds of things like that. Okay, future work. The first one reminds me of the verse in The Lord of the Rings about one ring to bind them all, one ring to bring them. I'd like to bring all the PPPD, all the PPP implementations together to use the generic layer. So I need to talk to the ISDN guys and also perhaps the Sync PPP maintainer, if such a person exists, and see if we can't restructure their code to use the generic layer. And if there's changes needed to the generic layer, that's cool. As I said before, in the process of restructuring PPPD to allow it to support diverse channel types, so that you can write your channel module for your packet radio and your plugin for PPP and PPPD, and that works fine. And last thing, one thing I've wanted to do for a while is to actually provide a way that you can make a socket connection to PPPD and connect to it from a GUI and query it for status information and perhaps give it commands to take the link up or down or sideways or whatever. Okay, any questions? Yeah?
Do you do load balancing over a multi-link?
The question was, do I do load balancing over multi-link? Yes, it does balance the load over the channels with multi-link. The way it works is that when it's got a packet to transmit, it looks to see which channels would be available to transmit a packet. And the way it does that is by seeing, it looks at the transmit queue for the channel, and if it's empty, then it says, okay, we can give that channel a fragment. And then it divides the packet between all of the channels that are free at the moment. Now, what this tends to do is that initially under conditions of light load, usually most of the channels will be empty and you'll tend to fragment the packet over all the channels. And that's good because it gives you reduced latency because the fragment is shorter on each channel. Then when you get under heavy load, very often there'll only be one channel free, and that tends to give you less fragmentation. So you're tending to put whole PPP packets out each channel and using them in turn. Now, if one channel is much slower than the others, then it will take a lot longer before it becomes free again, and you'll be tending to put packets out the other channels. So that's how the balancing's done. Ben?
Just one question about the multi-link thing. Does it have the provision for not transmitting packets with a multi-link header when using multi-link?
The question was, does the multi-link stuff have the provision for transmitting packets without a multi-link header when using multi-link? Okay. Yes, the answer is basically yes. Not data packets, but control packets, yes.
Data packets.
Oh, data packets? No. Okay, you can transmit packets by having an instance of devppp that's attached to the channel. If you write a packet to that channel, it will go directly to the channel without any processing at all, without any compression or multi-link header or anything. It'll just go to the channel as is. So that's how you can transmit a packet without a multi-link header, but not data packets. Why would you want to do that?
I'll talk to you about it.
Okay. Yes?
Isn't there a risk that the multi-link TPP will be older packets?
No. The question was, is there a risk that the multi-link PPP will reorder packets? If you read the multi-link spec, RFC 1717, no, that's the old one, 1990, I think it is. Yeah. The multi-link header contains a sequence number, and that sequence number is incremented for each fragment that goes out. And part of the reassembly process is actually to make sure that the fragments are processed in increasing sequence number order. So that makes sure that even if a packet arrives faster on one channel than the other, that the first fragment or packet gets processed first at the receiver. Yeah?
Basically, if you have one very slow link and one very fast link, the fast link will have to wait for the slow link because you have to reorder the packets.
The processing of the packets on the fast link would have to wait until the packet is fully come through on the slow link, that's true. And in fact, there are situations where if you've got a fast link and a slow link with TCP, perhaps sometimes the total bandwidth you see will just be twice the bandwidth of the slow link. That can happen. But it should still be possible to use the bandwidth of the faster link, okay, so that several packets will go through on the faster link and they'll just get queued up. And then the one on the slow link eventually gets through. It'll get processed, and then all the ones on the faster link will get through. So it's possible to get the full bandwidth. But then you get interactions with TCP round-trip time estimation and retransmission and all that sort of TCP nastiness. Yeah? The question was, how difficult would it be to get PPP working over a USB connection? Now, do you mean a USB serial port, or do you mean... Okay. I think the USB serial stuff actually creates a TDY device, doesn't it? I'm pretty sure that's right, that when you have a USB serial port, that the USB code actually creates a TDY device, and then you can just run the standard PPP stuff on that serial device. Some people have asked in the past about connecting USB to two computers and using that as a kind of network between them. Now, in fact, you need, because USB is very strictly a master-slave type bus, the host is the master and controls everything on the bus, you can't just connect a USB cable between two computers. But you can get boxes that have basically got a bit of RAM in them and two USB slave connections so that one computer can write some stuff into the RAM and then the other computer can read it. If you had that sort of thing, you could do PPP over that by creating a channel type that knew how to send the USB commands to actually read and write that RAM. Questions? Okay, thank you.